Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Vinyl. This episode, we're joined by Bobby Blitz from Overkill, thrash metal legends, hailing from New Jersey back in the 80s. Great guy, Blitz. This is a chat we had a little while ago, it's finally seeing you, finally getting out to you guys. So hope you enjoy. He's a super, super character. Lovely man, loves to laugh, and I'm sure you will enjoy.
Alrighty, we're back with another episode of Behind the Vinyl. I've got Nicholas over there.
Yes.
Hello, mate. Nice to see you yet again.
Nice to
see you. And we're joined by Bobby from Overkill. Blitz, nice to see you, man.
Aaron, always a pleasure. Nick, great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you, man.
Blitz and I got a little bit of history here. We worked right back together from the Spitfire days. I can remember your son when he was younger, 17 or 18, coming on tour with you, coming through London then as well.
2002, I think that was. I think it was the Bloodletting tour. And we were at the Underground in Camden, right?
That's correct. Absolutely.
What a shit show that was, man. That was like putting 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag, you know? I mean, it was just, the walls were heaving. I remember I slapped some hands in the audience and somebody copped my wedding ring during that show. I went in with my left hand, because I only played the place once. I went in with my left hand and the guy grabbed my hand, slid the wedding ring right off. And I stopped the show and said, all right. It's not going to be any trouble unless you don't give it fucking back. I got it back.
Good. I can also remember when we shot the DVD, I kind of flew over. I landed the day you guys were recording it up there in New Jersey.
Yeah, that's correct.
Exactly. And I had to make my way up there and I kind of asked the person. I was staying in New York, and I asked the person at the lobby of the hotel, "Hey, how do I get up there?" And he's like, "You don't want to go up there." I'm like, "Yeah, I want to go up there." "No, you don't. You don't want to go up there."
You know, that whole area's changed. That had a that was Asbury Park, New Jersey, and it was a jewel on the coast for years. But then Atlantic City opened up farther south. And what ended up happening was all the Atlantic City money was keeping Asbury Park from developing. And it started going down, you know, into the toilet. You know, year by year, it was just worse, you know, abandoned buildings and the whole bit. But now it's actually, since the DVD, it's been regentrified. There's just a whole new community in there that's taken it to another level. But there was something about that DVD, that shoot back then, 2001. That was that because it was CD, it made the DVD better. You know what I mean? I mean, it wasn't like Overkill doesn't play, you know, the Royal Albert Hall. Or Carnegie Hall. Overkill plays Asbury Park.
Yeah. I love it. Just before we dig into that, how much do you think New Jersey really had on shaping Overkill for what they are?
I think this was always New Jersey is where New York thinks it dumps its garbage. New York is more of the elitist community. Manhattan, especially. New Jersey was always the working class. So I think that the work ethic that came here that, you know, we always shared from our relatives. I mean, Dee Dee and I have pretty much the same background. He has a large Italian-American family. I have a large Irish-American family. The only difference is food. You know, I mean, the work ethics are the same. You know, you'd hear from your uncles, work hard and keep your secrets to yourself, keep your fucking mouth shut. You know, and that was... is something that Overkill has always done. It's been about hard work and for sure not airing our dirty laundry in public. If that gets aired, it's not coming from our mouths. You know, we'll argue behind closed doors, but when we leave that room to present ourselves to the public or anyone else, we speak in one voice because we've had our disagreement behind the door. But when we come out, it's a unified approach or a unified voice. And I think that that's a huge part of how Overkill survived or been shaped. And that's a, you know, quite a New Jersey thing. You know, keep your mouth shut, work hard.
But what was the whole New Jersey scene like back when you started out? Was there a lot of bands happening?
Well, what we had back in New Jersey as, you know, I was kind of formulating to finding my way around a microphone was we had a huge club scene here. Now, primarily that club scene was cover bands, right. But they would cover the flavors of the day. But one of those cover bands, for instance, that would play six nights a week was Twisted Sister. So, I mean, you had a huge, a great opportunity to see them. You know, you could see them 12 times a year if you wanted. You know, in just in New Jersey, or more so. But they'd play Long Island, they'd play Connecticut, they'd play New York State. You know, they were kind of a circuit band, and we had this great circuit of clubs where you could go somewhere every night. So, you know, with regard to formulating things, all you had to add to it was the original music to make a breakout.
Everybody out on
So let's you started in 1980. Let's bring it all the way right up to the new the latest record, The Wings of War. Like 40 years, mate. You've been going for 40 years, 39 years, and you recorded this record. Come out February 22nd, 2019. That's an unbelievable legacy and still going strong to this day.
Well, he who dies with the most toys wins. That's just... I mean, I suppose for the metal genre, there may be one or two that are ahead of us in this that have started before us, but we've been pretty much like clockwork. I think that when you asked about Jersey prior, we always had we had a great understanding of how we would be visible because we were for sure an underground band. I mean, we enjoyed the fruits of the major labels back in, the late 80s, early 90s, where the money was plentiful and eventually the cocaine went away. But I think that we were always that underground band, and we understood that we weren't getting that major radio play, that, primetime MTV stuff, video after video. There was going to be one video for the record, maybe two. It would be played during Headbangers Ball. That was going to be our exposure to the United States at that particular time. And places in Europe, obviously. There was Headbangers Ball over there, and I think Viva was doing some stuff. But we knew that if we worked on a clock where every 2 years, it would be hard to forget about us, even if you didn't like us. We're just not going away. You're either going to accept it or not. We're like nuclear cockroaches here. There is no fucking exterminator.
We'll be right back.
It's also said, I think it was you that said this, that I'm just looking for the quote and I pulled it out. It's still fun as hell making Overkill records, having made this record. Did you find... Are you there?
Oh, there you go. Sorry, that just... somebody tried to call in. I don't understand why the phone went off.
Right.
You've been quoted as saying it's still fun as hell making Overkill records off the back of this record. Did you find that this record is just as fun as making it's your 19th record, just as fun making?
Well, sure. It's about opportunity. I think that's the key word. If you have an opportunity that comes your way and for sure you have the work ethic we just spoke about, it becomes exciting. After 19 records, it's going to be identifiable as Overkill, of course, but we notice the different nuances within the writing, within what that 19th record will reveal to us with regard to newness or with regard to excitement.
Yep. Love it. And obviously, it's the first record with Jason. Jason playing drums, formerly of Shadows Fall, and he was in Flotsam and Jetsam for a while. When did he come in? Did he come in for the, obviously, just for before pre-production, right?
He actually toured with us prior. He had toured a whole entire year prior, so he had been with us since 17. We had Eddie Garcia, who was our sound guy. He's also a drummer in Pissing Razors, a band out of El Paso, Texas.
Awesome.
Eddie filled in, did a DVD that we had recorded live in Oberhausen, Germany. Did a couple of tours with us, but just couldn't commit to it on a full-time basis. And, you know, it was starting to get where Eddie was going to be sliding out. And I was sitting in Minnesota and I said, oh, God, I got Bittner's number in here. I had to give Jason a call. And it was a real simple audition. Hey, man, you want the gig? He goes, give me 10 minutes. So I'm going to talk to my wife. I was like, okay. So, but he brought, you know, he's a state-of-the-art kind of guy. I mean, he's an absolute machine. If you want consistency, man, I knew the band changed, you know, in the third song with him on his first day in the Ukraine. I was like, the band's going to be different. But that's a good thing. That was those nuances that we could measure in the Wings of War.
I'm thinking also, I mean, you and Didi being the last man standing, and the last man standing is the first track of the album, but that also has to be such a big thing of getting someone new to come into the band. There's so much more than just being a great player. There's got to be the whole chemistry of being together in a band, being out on the road and all that. How do you look at that?
Well, you know, the most important thing for me, I mean, sure, I mean, I want great results when we come out of the studio, but I think camaraderie brings us great results. There's an expression here, if we're not busting your balls, it means we don't like you. If we're polite, we don't like you. Don't trust us then. But and I think that, you know, when Jason came in and he's from the area, or at least to some degree, he's a couple hours north of me. He's an East Coast guy. He has that about him, and that helps people loosen up. Then, you know, then there's transparency when it comes to communication. When you're trying to convey ideas, they become transparent because you can bust each other's balls. And if you can do that, you're having fun simultaneously with creating stuff that are new opportunities. That is a new opportunity, like the Wings of War. So Jason started busting balls by day five, you know, I mean, pulling pranks. I mean, the entire thing, I'm going, can you believe this fucking kid? He's been here for a week. and having him as the kid, you know, Jason, I guess, is 10 years younger than me, 10 or 11 years younger. You know, it's all on a scale. You know, I mean, I remember when I was married, I would get, you know, my wife would say to me, you're like being married to a 12-year-old sometimes. I said, well, and what's the fucking problem with that? I said, that should excite you sometimes. But the scale of age, I think Jason adds youth is what I was trying to allude to.
Great, cool. In regards to you and Didi, how does it come in regards to writing, in particular this record? How did you start approaching that?
Well, you know, I got a couple of funny Didi stories, and one of them is, you know, I'm doing the demos right now. I mean, they're right next to me here on an iPod, and I'm going to we're doing the 20th record, and for I don't know, 3 decades, I call him as soon as I get his riff ideas, and I leave a message that says, I'm a fucking professional, I don't know how you expect me to write to this fucking garbage. And and I think that's, you know, the approach. He gets a laugh out of it. We don't discuss it in depth. We try to let it, you know, form itself. You know, I know his riffs. I know what he comes up with. He tries to push himself out of the box. He has an array of tools that he's used, but he tries to take those tools and present them in a different way from year to year, record to record. And he's got that, you know, that sludgy groove stuff. He's got the thrash stuff. He's got the speed stuff. He's got a lot of rock and roll in him. And, geez, and a hell of a lot of punk rock, you know. So when you start mixing that up into a bag, you don't know exactly what you're going to come out with as the writer. So to over-talk simplicity kind of fucks up the simplicity. So he does some stuff and with some finger drums, sends it all to me, sends it to Dave Linsk, sends it to Jason. And then we kind of come back and put it together to see how, you know, each of us thought of it objectively. And I think that's where we get the best results. I remember back, we were doing a record called, it might have even been for Spitfire back then. It was From the Underground and Below, 1997. And, you know, I was having a cup of coffee with him one morning. And I said, what are you thinking about the new record? And he goes, you know, listen, man. He goes, we're not going to reinvent the wheel. You know, I mean, we are what we are. And I said, yeah, but you don't want to discuss any of it? He said, and this was the best thing this guy ever said to me. He goes, Blitz, we've been over since Horoscope. There's nothing more dangerous than two guys from Jersey with nothing to lose. I said, pretty good. It's a great quote, you know, because it freed up my head, you know, that many years ago to say, hey, you know something? He's right. Fuck it. Let's just see what happens with this. That's the fun of it. I'm running, give me the light, give me place, and here we are, our team. I know.
I mean, after 40 years, you must know each other so well. Also, when it comes to making music.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you know, I mean, it's of course. I mean, I think the biggest connection for us is the band. I mean, we're not, and never have been. I mean, we go to, you know, the graduations of the kids and stuff like so, and occasionally get together outside of that, run into each other at concert. But, you know, I mean, we have the same backgrounds. Like I said earlier, we kind of know what to expect from each other. I mean, it only works because we have the same principles. And, you know, the principle is, you know, put the man first or put the men first. The band will take care of itself, you know? I mean, a guy has a problem and says, hey, I got a problem with my kids. I don't think I can make it on the road. We say, do what you have to do. You know, it's not a matter of, you have to be here. So I think for us, it's the band has worked itself out because of the principles we have as people and putting the person before the band.
Right.
Love it.
Right.
Love it. Here's a question I'm interested about. You guys produced the record yourselves. How do you find that? Do you like to do that? Do you like to have that complete control or how does that compare to you in regards to bringing someone else that can try to push you guys and bring different elements out of you?
Well, I think that, you know, I just talked about us looking at it objectively. I think there becomes the push. It's not always four guys who are in that writing mode thinking exactly the same thing. So it's not, you know, it's not a room full of chiefs. There's some Indians in there too.
Right, yeah.
So I production, you know, when we look at production, and Didi's always been into it. I mean, he had a studio for years that was, you know, commercial studio. People could come in and do a record. And, you know, as the industry started getting thinner and us again not being, you know, still being an underground band, we could score deals and keep the money in the family by doing the albums at his studio and also have, you know, the luxury of going in there and saying, listen, I want to blow some tracks out. I got some new stuff. And he's like, hey, I got stuff booked for the next 3 hours, but come down, you know, at 4 o'clock and I'll set up the vocal mic for you.
Yep.
So I think that production just became natural then. And when I look at production for all the records that we've done, I mean, right back from the beginning, we were interested in it. It's really about getting the right tones, the right guitar tones, making sure everything is set up, all your T's and are crossed and your I's are dotted, and keeping everything fucking organized. So the guy that's going to mix it goes, oh, this is easy to do. So production, as far as we go, I don't think we need the push, because the push comes from four separate ideas with regard to which way the song should go.
Of the song Welcome to the Garden State, New Jersey, of course, being the Garden State as far as I can remember. There's a soprano sample in there. Things like that. Is that hard to get licensed or whatever you do for it, or you pay for it or whatever? How does that work?
I'm not at liberty to speak about that right now. Listen, I just went over to you guys. Are you paying attention? I mean, I'm sitting right fucking here. We wanted, you know, Tommy Jones did that video for us. Tommy works at Nuclear out in L.A. and was their video guy, their visual guy, and actually is a higher position at this particular time in his career. But he's a New Jersey guy. So, the thing for us is that we've always, you know, we've kind of always thought locally but acted globally. You know, I mean, we wear it in our sleeves. You know, we're proud individuals. That may be the thing that brings us down one day, but we're proud dudes. I mean, we like the fact that we're from here and that, you know, you can kind of smell it on us and hear it on us when we talk. You know, but Tommy, we had done this kind of docu-series for the Wings of War, which we called Welcome to the Garden State, where Tommy flew in with Jackie Duza, also NB, and filmed like this docu-series of us in segments as a lead up to the record, instead of us sitting there, you know, saying, oh yeah, we recorded here and we're in front of a green screen and they're putting the album artwork behind us. We're walking down the boardwalk in Asbury Park where I saw Darren, whatever it was, 20 years ago. We're talking about the old days, and it was a great docuseries. And then when we decided to do that as the video, we said, this is the guy who should do it. He's a New Jersey guy. He'll be able to go all the ins and outs, and he knows all the places. So I think it really worked for us, incorporating that and the sound bites and Tommy's knowledge, geographical knowledge of the state, where the great things were that he could film. And I think it was a great success.
Cool.
Absolutely. Is there any songs that stand out for you, whether it's the writing process or the finish process that really stands out for you?
Well, you were talking about, having someone else produce the record and earlier, and I remember, two songs. Distortion, which I thought was really different because of the intro. I think that was these guys kind of Queen moment with regard to guitars and bass. It was almost a majestic type introduction to that. And I think it totally set the tone for a song that was a little outside the box for us. Just that kind of heavy pounding groove. But the one that really was the production juggernaut was Head of a Pin. It was the last song I personally finished because I had written it like 15 fucking times, over the course of a 6-month period, because the other guys were pushing me. They're going, oh, it's, yeah, that's pretty good. And you can tell as soon as, they look like they're smelling shit when they're listening to it, And I think, it inspired me to go, okay, they obviously know I can do better. They just don't know how to tell me how to do it. And so when the song, I was writing that right up until the day I was recording it. And then the night before I was like, that's fucking it. This is it right here. And it was out of the box again. It was it was like Sabbath on crystal meth. And it just felt right. And it felt right to all of us. So Head of a Pin and Distortion would be the two that stand out to me.
Great. Head of the Pin obviously was one of the singles too. I think it was the second single. First single was Last Man Standing, right?
That's correct. That was, they did it on a lyric video, the modern era of the single. Yeah.
Talked about producing. You just get your house in order, basically your housework in order, and send it off. You had Zeus mixing. I think it was the first time Zeus has worked for you, right?
Yeah, that was. He's also done. He's done stuff with Jason.
Exactly. Prior
stuff with in Shadows. He did some stuff. He did stuff with me on his solo projects. So both of these guys had experience with them. We were playing, some festival in Mexico. We were playing with, and Judas Priest was on it. And it was killer because we're on some stage about a half a mile from the stage they're on. So I had one of the techs take a picture over my shoulder so you could see, you know, Rob Halford's head on the huge screen there. And I sent my mother and my friends, the picture said, "Look, I'm playing with Judas Priest." You know, he's like three quarters of the way. But we ran into Andy Sneap there, who had been filling in for Glenn, and he was slated to do the record. And he actually came into the dressing room and said, "Listen, it's just not going to happen. These guys are booked from now until when you guys are going to be done." So it was pretty simple, you know. I mean, it was real forthcoming of him to come over and do it that way instead of in an email or something. So he hung around the dressing room for an hour and a half, and we talked music. But the first name that came up was Zeus, and the fact that Dee Dee and Jason had great experiences with him, and Jason being the new guy, and we're taking his okay on this. You know, Dave Linsky and I are standing there going, "Well, you know, the stuff that he did sounds great." So it was just, it was a simple process for us. There was never another consideration. Just we went right to Zeus and he said, "Love to do it."
Love it.
Cool.
Because obviously Andy Sneap, you'd worked with him on previous albums. The guy's mm-hmm. a master. Yeah.
That's right. He brought something new to the party in that production. I mean, he just made it so much, it was just so much more, it was so loud. Is what it seemed like, that production. It seemed like a loud production, that it was right in your face, but it wasn't hard to listen to. Some productions are so loud, and after you listen to three songs, you're kind of wondering why your eyes twitch, you know? And when you listen to it at a really loud level because of the frequencies that are coming in there and putting pins into your brain.
But I'm wondering, where did the album title come from, The Wings of War?
You know, that was the last thing that was attached to it. we were going with all sorts of different things prior to that. We usually like to have a working title because it gives you some type of a vision in your head, or at least a picture of where you're headed with it. For instance, the Ironbound record. I mean, that the Ironbound record, you know, everybody thinks that the whole thing is based strictly on something that is metallic without any thought to it. But it's a neighborhood in Newark, New Jersey, is the Ironbound. And it's an old Portuguese neighborhood that is right off of the seaport. And it got its nickname because it was a seaport neighborhood that when you would fly over the Ironbound, it looked like that neighborhood was bound to the earth by iron rails. And these were all the trains that came out of the seaport. So that, for instance, gave us that kind of mentality when we were going through this. Everybody else is going, you know, the rest of the world's going, oh, that's cool. They used the word iron in the... But with this title, The Wings of War, we were dumbfounded. We were using Distortion Riot, you know, and we were taking songs and putting, you know, half of the song here, you know, Last Man's Distortion, you know, Distortion Man, something like so. And it just wasn't working for us. And then we went to Travis Smith, who did the art for it, and we said we want something different. We want it to look as almost like you could make a pin out of it or a badge, you know, if it was made out of pewter or something, almost like a piece of merchandise, but valuable. And he came up with this, you know, the five skulls sitting around the table with the O glowing in it. And I think it was Dave or Dee Dee said, looks like a war council. And I went home. And the artwork was done, and I was using war and war this, war that, and then the Wings of War just showed up, and that was actually the last element to the record.
Just Overkill, just touching on Overkill in general. You guys are kind of, it's your longevity, your tenacity, your determination just to stick through it and go. You're kind of playing and recording better or as equal as what you have done at your finer points, you know? This is such a strong record.
Yeah, I think so. It's always hard for me to tell, you know, unless, you know, until a couple of years pass. And then I can tell where the record kind of sits within the discography. But I think that we're releasing quality stuff. But I also think it's a really healthy scene right now. And I think that we're for sure a reflection of that healthy scene. You know, there's just, you know, people are taking time, like, you know, your blog, your radio show, you know, it's a bona fide scene metal, you know, it always has been, but it's the guys that were, you know, fans in their teenage years have now become the people who are running the scene. And I think that that's a great testimony to something with value. And if it has value, it bleeds into the people who are creating the music, not just us. I mean, all the bands that are releasing quality material, you know, in their later years or so many years down the road. I think you become a reflection of what you're part of. And we've obviously been part of it for 40 years. And, you know, I run into these guys, you know, the naysayers. It's like, oh, man, remember the good old fucking days? I'm like, you're not paying attention, asshole. It's pretty good right now. we're not selling a ton of records, but I don't think the scene itself has ever been stronger.
No, I think it's great. Like artists with catalog are releasing the best, like yourself, releasing the best stuff they've ever done. New artists that are coming through are just, you know, they're on top of the game. I think it's great. Something else I find, and people like yourself are suddenly being pulled out for credibility. We had Danko Jones on here. It was quite a while ago, he was. Have you met Danko?
Yes, I have. Yeah, great dude.
Great guy. Such a music guy. Very passionate. And he was up in arms waving and screaming, and you know, throwing props to Overkill and you know, demanding that you guys should be in the big four kind of thing. And that's and that's something that I think is really showing nowadays. A lot of these younger bands are definitely throwing props to a lot of the older, more established artists.
Well, hang on here. I got to take a little note here. Send Danko the rest of the money. He's a great guy. He's he's a fan. I'm not just saying Overkill. He's a fan of music. You can tell by, you know, his eclectic approach to things that he likes, you know, many different things. And I think that that's something to be celebrated. But there's, you know, there's credibility in this. I think from where we come from, I mean, you know, you've done it this long. You're the real deal. You know, I mean, you throw me into a room with, you know, 100 other musicians. It takes me 5 minutes to tell you who the real ones are and who the posers are, you know, because, I mean, I have that experience. I got that radar. So I think that credibility lends itself to, you know, let's say the longevity that we enjoy at this time and many of the other bands, too.
Same. You have to say, I wouldn't change the way.
Blows, I mean, during these 40 years, I mean, has there ever been a time where you ever thought, you know, fuck it, I'm done?
You know, not really, because, you know, I've always done other things. I mean, that was never the issue. But this was the thing that I loved, and it was probably the biggest bond I had with Dee Dee, is that we both, you know, we both loved it. And I remember back in the Spitfire days, you know, with Darren, and actually before that, we were on a label called CMC, which was Tom Lipsky. He was down out of North Carolina. I mean, shit, man. I got in a car. We were like coming out of the Atlantic deal, and I got in a fucking car, and I rode all the way to North Carolina from New Jersey, you know, with the demo. Threw it on his desk. Said we want a deal. I think a week later, he's up in New York saying, the fucking balls these guys have. But I, you know, but the cool thing was, is that the times were going to get lean. And we knew that. They gave us a heads up. They were going to access from the Atlantic Records. Our management was kind of losing interest, but we had been paying attention to how they had managed us. So we were learning all this time. We were learning, you know, how to make this happen under all circumstances. So when the times did get lean, we started managing ourselves. So let's say from 95 until the current day, and starting off in those leaner times, we found deals. We found Spitfire. You know, we moved to, you know, there's a new label starting over here, Bodog. We went to Nuclear Blast. We went to E1. So it's really the most proud time I have in the band, because it wasn't easy to do. You know, it was, we were doing it when not the whole world wanted it, but only a select few. So when everybody else went home and, you know, and started living with their parents because nobody would appreciate their genius, we were still pounding the pavement. So when the scene became healthy again, we were in the perfect fucking position to just level them. You know, to like say, okay, this is going to be a fucking fastball and I'm going to knock this out of the park. And that was somewhere, you know, in the late, you know, the first decade of the 2000s. And so we were prepared, even though it was a hard time to do it, but it was never a thought to say, hey, let's stop this. It was, what can we do to make it happen at a higher level?
Right. Also, I'm thinking, I mean, what are your memories of signing with Atlantic, a major legendary label? What was that like?
Well, you know, we never really signed with them directly. It was a addendum to the contract because they've been distributing us through Megaforce Records. They were distributing Megaforce, so taking over Under the Influence, Years of Decay. So Horoscope came along, and Megaforce was renegotiating the Atlantic thing and wasn't sure if they were going to go to it. And John Zazula wasn't sure he was going to continue on doing what he was doing. So we were just kind of moved over to Atlantic. There wasn't this big... We just signed the addendum back in 87, and then by the time 91 came along, we were directly on Atlantic, like many of the other Megaforce bands, Testament, King's X at that time. But I remember, you know, I remember sitting with somebody and talking, you know, strategy for promo. And, you know, it was a suit and tie kind of person that, and he said, excuse me, I have to take this phone call. And he got out of the room. I looked at Didi and I go, well, fuck, he knows nothing about him. But I mean, they did good things for us. I mean, yeah, because they were, you know, the ultimate promotion machine. We was going to do videos. They were going to make sure that we were touring. It was going to be tour. But you knew that your days were numbered. You knew it was only a matter of time until we go somewhere else, because they're just not going to be happy unless the band becomes Metallica. That's the right. The only way they're going to keep you is that if you are the next Metallica. But right. They, you know, to their credit, they had they finished the Horoscope campaign with us. They did I Hear Black. They did WFO, and it was Adios Amigo.
Take major engine, take
40 years. I mean, what would you say are some of the highlights through all these years with the band Overkill?
Well, I mean, the biggest highlight is still being able to do it. You know, I mean, I've rode motorcycles and walked around in engineer boots for 40 years in Levi's and played heavy metal. You know, I mean, that's a successful highlight right there.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what did you want to do with your life? Nothing. I still got the Harley I bought, like, you know, back in the 90s, you know, wow. Because I can't get rid of it because it's from the, let's say it's from the fruits of Overkill. You know, right. It represents more to me than, oh, I need a cooler bike. It was cool when I bought it. You know, all I do is keep it, you know, upgraded. But the point is that it's given me everything that, you know, yeah. I've had. You know, I mean, I'm talking from the house that it provided for me. You know, a lot of guys can't say that. And I'm not comparing because, I mean, there's so many more successful guys than us. But the satisfaction that comes for doing this for 40 years and being able to live your life the way you want to live it. I mean, fuck, man. It's like when you're a little kid playing pirate, you know? I want to be a pirate when I grow up. That's kind of, that actually happened.
Well, that's a cool, I mean, going back to the song Welcome to the Garden State, where you actually say, been everywhere, but it's never like home.
Good point.
Yeah.
I know when I cross the line, you know, when I cross the state line, I know I'm home, you know, it's, and I've seen beautiful places, you know, whether that be Sweden, whether that be the UK, Asia, and, you know, I've kind of been everywhere, but yeah. This always makes me feel, you know, it always makes me feel I'm supposed to be here. You know, we always say New Jersey's got such high taxes, it's designed to keep a good man down. But we're so fucking pigheaded, we won't leave.
So swing forward all these years. You just mentioned that there's another record. What else is on the Blitz cards at the moment? I know you've got a solo, a side project at the moment, and also you've got you mentioned a new Overkill record there.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange time, as you know, as we were talking to each other going back and forth, you know, and I don't want to harp on the negativity of it. I think that, you know, people are in a situation right now where they appreciate the positive elements of what goes on in lives, not mine, for instance, but I know I'm real appreciative when I see other people, you know, getting through these shitty times that we're in. But if it's business as usual, then the business of the past was valid, and that's what we're doing. I mean, we're doing you know, the 20th Overkill record. I mean, I got 9 songs on this iPad, and I'm going to, you know, I'm scratching lyrics out and vocal lines. Didi's working on with Jason, talking about some drum stuff, and they're going through it, and Jason's interpreting it to his own. Well, we're going to start recording as soon as we can get out of this place. So we're going to live life, you know, on our own terms. And I think that that's what all people, you know, want to do at this particular time. So listen, shit changes, concerts are canceled. We're figuring shit out, whether it's virtual concerts, whether it's side projects, like the one I did with Portnoy, Demel and Mengi. There's make shit fucking happen. And that's the simplicity of this. I mean, we'll all get through the thing. It's just a matter of whether we do it with a smile on our face or a frown.
Absolutely.
Right. True.
Blitz, thanks for your time, man. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, as always.
And watch for my stand-up comedy routine, too.
Yeah. And never stop being a pirate.
Gentlemen, it was a pleasure.
You as well, mate. Well, take care, mate. Talk to you soon. We'll be right back.
Elimination! Elimination!